Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it was one of those truly dramatic moments this morning at the White House. George Bush came out and announced that he was going to pardon a turkey as the turkey handler started walking a large white bird down the aisle. Scooter Libby came running out, pushed the bird aside, and jumped up on the table. Our quote for the day, greetings, my friends. Our quote for the day from Jon Stewart of The Daily Show. He says, I celebrated Thanksgiving in an old-fashioned way. I invited everyone in my neighborhood to my house. We had an enormous feast, and then I killed them and took their land. Our guest to start out, what are you thankful for today? Tomorrow is Thanksgiving. I am thankful for my family. I am thankful for my parents who gave me life and those who preceded them. I'm thankful for this extraordinary nation and the people who have fought and died for it all these years. I'm thankful for the Enlightenment that birthed it. I'm thankful for my children. I'm thankful for the great people here in Portland, at Clear Channel and in New York City at Air America who helped make this program possible. I'm thankful for so much. And we'll get into what you're thankful for, too, as the day goes on at 866-303-2270. In our second hour, by the way, Scott Horton, the contributing editor of Harper's Magazine, is going to be with us. He's thankful that there's a possibility that the criminals in the Bush administration might get prosecuted after the 21st of January, and he will be telling us who and how and why. And in our third hour, Jeff Golden's going to drop by for our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. He has a new novel out, Unafraid. What would have happened if John Kennedy had never been assassinated? It should be an interesting day. And Larry Scott with our VA Watchdog segment for the week, the Veterans segment. But right now, Ken Davis is with us, Kenneth Davis. He is the author of so many wonderful books, one of my favorite historians, Kenneth C. Davis. His website, don'tknowmuch.com. It's the Don't Know Much series. Don't know much about the Bible, don't know much about the Civil War, don't know much about geography, don't know much about history, which is just a wonderful starting point. Don't know much about mythology, don't know much about anything, and as new as don't know much about anything else. Kenneth Davis, don'tknowmuch.com. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, and always a pleasure, and thank you for having me, so I'm thankful for that.
Oh, that's
always
great.
A pleasure, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken. Let's just go through some of the myths and realities about Thanksgiving.
I have to ask you first. One turkey always gets pardoned, but what about the other turkeys? I mean, it just means that somebody else gets, you know, has to take his place.
Well, we
not
saw
like
that.
We
saw that the day before yesterday with Sarah Palin. She, I don't
that's,
know if you.
That's right. With the scene that looked like it came from Fargo.
Yeah, I know. It was like kind of a bad Kafka movie. If they ever made a movie out of Kafka, I don't know, but it reminded me of The Prisoner, you know. Anyway,
what can I tell you about these turkeys?
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, let's just go through common thoughts and beliefs about Thanksgiving. The Pilgrims, they always wore stiff black clothes and shoes with silver buckles.
Well, that was kind of the way they were depicted by the late 19th century when artists kind of started to idealize them. And it really was more of an image of the Puritans who come a little bit later in Massachusetts history. And we can sort out the difference between a Puritan and a Pilgrim in a minute if you like. But no, the Pilgrims who came on the Mayflower was very simple farming people that they would have worn what farmers in 1620 wore, which was colored clothes that were, you know, browns and reds and purples and simple, very simple things. That very stylized black somber with the formal hat really is what the Puritans looked like. And, of course, the Puritans followed the Pilgrims to Massachusetts a little bit later, and then they took over.
Now, there was a period in British history where a theocracy was installed for, you would know, my recollection is it was 7 years, Cromwell.
Cromwell.
And you know, following that theocracy, the people associated with him, who, as I recall, were the Puritans, and I may have this all wrong. I mean, it's been a lot of years since I studied British history. Isn't there a relationship between the British, as it were, revolution or civil war or overthrow of Cromwell and all that, the British experiment with theocracy and the people who came to the United States?
Sure. All of it is connected, and it really goes back to the importance of the religious wars over the Protestant Reformation that aren't just in England. In fact, I write about the people who came to America as the real first pilgrims 50 years before the Mayflower sailed. They were French Protestants. They came to America and landed in Florida. They had the good sense to go to Florida in June instead of Massachusetts in December. And this was 50 years before the Mayflower sailed, but they came for the same reasons, to escape the religious bloodshed in France at that time. When the Spanish learn that the French Protestants are there, however, they send a fleet over and wipe them out, and the admiral who kills these French Protestants hangs a sign over them that says, "I do this not as Frenchmen, but as to heretics." So this whole period is really a period of tremendous religious warfare, and that's part of the story of the birth of America. And what story is more important for our times? Actually, have a piece on the New York Times op-ed page about those first pilgrims today, and it's one of those stories that got completely left out of our history books.
Well, my recollection is that they seriously contaminated and for some time ran Massachusetts, that these were the people who had been basically run out of England because they were theocrats, and that Ben Franklin left Massachusetts.
Yeah, we should.
Because he wanted to avoid these people. I mean, they were still, you know, Mary, what was her name, in the late 1600s, was the last woman to be hanged or burned or whatever as a witch in Massachusetts? Hanged, I think it was?
Well, we should go back to another Mary. The daughter of King Henry VIII is Mary, and she, unlike her father, was a devout Catholic and tried, and this is, again, this whole period of fighting over religion in England, she tried to bring Catholicism back to England and put a lot of Protestants to death for it, and that's the reason that she was known as Bloody Mary. Her half-sister then succeeded her, Elizabeth. Elizabeth came to the throne and was a Protestant herself and far more tolerant. Philip in Spain had married Mary. He wanted to marry Elizabeth after Mary died, and Elizabeth said no. So Philip said, "Well, if I can't marry her, I'll kill her." And so you had this tremendous period of warfare going on.
Was this Elizabeth the First around 1600?
That's Elizabeth the First, is the half sister of Mary, and Philip, who had married Mary, and you know, this is this incredible tangle of the European courts at that time. Yeah. But this is the whole background to these people wanting to leave England. The people we call the Pilgrims, they did not think that the Church of England, which had broken away from Catholicism, had gone far enough. They wanted to completely separate from it. They were separatists, and that's why they really got kicked out of England first, went to Holland, weren't happy there, and then they get this opportunity to come to America. Now, only half of the people who are on the Mayflower fall into that category of what we would think of as pilgrims, people coming for religious freedom. The other half were people who were courted by the stock owners of the Mayflower to come over and start this new settlement. This was actually early American venture capitalism. There was money behind the Mayflower venture, and it was supposed to turn a profit. And so half of the people are pilgrims, or saints as they called themselves, and the other half of the 102 passengers are strangers, simply people who were coming for an opportunity to get some land in the New World.
Right. Now, the famous Jonestown colony of, what was it, 1607? As I recall.
1607 is Jamestown, that's right.
It
that
vanished.
Has already been a step.
Now, there's been a lot of speculation over the years that they assimilated in with the Indians rather than simply starved. Any recent data on this?
Well, there's you might be sort of mixing
that up with something else.
There was an earlier colony that was settled in what is now North Carolina. They're famously known as the Lost Colony.
Right, that's what I'm
thinking.
Walter
Raleigh had started it. They disappeared, and they were supposed to get relief, a relief ship to come and help them out. They disappeared. There's only a carved word on a tree that said Croatoan, and there's always been speculation that they did move on and mix in with local native groups, and many people in that area of North Carolina still claim that the colonists of the Lost Colony. In 1607, you get a different story. That's John Smith coming to Jamestown and Pocahontas story. Again, tremendous story of how these people came to America, struggled with the help of the Indians, survived, but very soon after that were at war with them.
Let's dig just a little bit deeper, if we may, Ken Davis, after the break. Can you stick around?
Okay.
Ken Davis, don'tknowmuch.com is the website, one of our favorite historians on this day before Thanksgiving. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour, the day before Thanksgiving. What are you thankful for? Tom Hartman here with you. And look out for shoppers carrying frozen turkeys. That's the message that Irene Mormon Bailey conveyed to poor Mr. Fred Lewis Irvin. Well, maybe not so poor. He stole some money from a gas station, ran across the street to a Harris Teeter store just south of Raleigh. Began beating up poor Irene while trying to steal her car. She grabbed a frozen turkey and beat this guy bad. The police had to take her off him and take him away. So there you go. Kenneth Davis is with us, the author of Don't Know Much About Fill in the Blank, his most recent book, Don't Know Much About Anything Else, and Don't Know Much About History, a great book. Ken, first of all, let's clean up maybe some of my British history illiteracy, because I don't claim to be a scholar of British history. Was the Cromwellian period, tell me, when was the brief flirtation with theocracy in England, or did I just manufacture that in my own brain?
No, not at all. But it does play into this whole story that we're talking about, the period where the Protestants and Catholics and the Church of England, which was closer to Catholicism at that time than we think of it today, were battling for supremacy in these mid 1600s. Cromwell's protectorate, as it was known, meant that the shoe was on the other foot for a while in England, and so the people who had once been loyal to the Church of England, they got pushed out, and instead of going to Massachusetts, they went to Virginia. For instance, George Washington's relatives were loyalists, and this is the whole period known as the Cavaliers versus the Roundheads. The Cavaliers were the people loyal to the crown. The Roundheads were more of the Protestants. And we're talking about an English Civil War that where Cromwell ruled until about 1653. So,
was he a Catholic?
1649. Pardon?
Was he Catholic?
Was he Catholic?
Was Cromwell Catholic?
No, he was Protestant.
But not Church of England Protestant.
That's right.
Oh, interesting.
That's right. So where
did the Puritans come from out of this?
Well, the Puritans were people who were loyal to the Church of England, but didn't think that the Church of England had gone far enough in moving away from Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
And they run into trouble when King James the First, for whom the King James Bible is named, comes into power. And although he didn't really try and bring Catholicism back, they were trying to move the Church of England back towards a more Catholic position. So it's a little confusing, I know, but again, it's people fighting and dying and killing each other over their beliefs, and these are obviously Englishmen. And this is why in the late 1620s into 1630, about 20,000 Puritans start to leave England because they're really not welcome there under King James. They are being pushed out, and this great Puritan migration begins, about 20,000 people. And this was when Massachusetts really exploded in population, where New England really started to grow rapidly, starting in 1630 when Governor Bradford comes over with the Arabella.
Yeah, Bradford of the Shining City on the Hill speech, was he not?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. And the first Thanksgiving, this was just a regular harvest feast that the Indians had, was it not?
It really was a harvest feast to a pilgrim. Certainly at that time, a day of Thanksgiving would have meant something very different, and to the Puritans as well, would have meant a day of fasting and prayer. Now, some of us will be praying tomorrow, but there won't be a lot of fasting going on. What they were celebrating, obviously, in 1621 was, first of all, that they had survived. Half of the 102 Mayflower passengers, the settlers, died in that first year. It's astonishing attrition rates. 18 adult women were on the Mayflower. Only 4 of them were alive on that first Thanksgiving day, which probably happened in October, not November. In fact, Canada's Thanksgiving Day is in October, more appropriately to at least in terms of the pilgrims. The November date came about because Abraham Lincoln proclaimed this a holiday in 1863, and he made it the last Thursday in November. This was a holiday that a woman named Sarah Josepha Hale had been lobbying for about 30 years. She was a magazine editor, a magazine of its time called Lady Godey's Book, a kind of good housekeeping of its day. So I guess old Sarah Josepha Hale was the Martha Stewart of her time. And she had really kept up this drumbeat for a national holiday to honor the pilgrims and to honor the beginnings of America. And Abraham Lincoln finally pronounces it in November of 1863.
We have just a half a minute left, Ken Davis. How many Indians altogether, Native Americans, died as a consequence of this?
You know, that's a number that's very hotly debated. If we're talking about, you know, how many were in the two Americas when Columbus arrived in 1492, the numbers range up from, you know, 30 or 40 million to over 100 million. And the vast majority of those die mostly as a result of disease, smallpox in particular.
Smallpox and influenza. Ken Davis, Kenneth Davis, don'tknowmuch.com is his website. His books, Don't Know Much About History, the Civil War, Geography, or anything else. Ken, thank you so much.
The new one, America's Hidden History.
Oh, America's Hidden History. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
For the rest of us, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to teamster.org for more information. And I've just been handed this public service announcement to read to our listeners. Dear world, the United States of America, your quality supplier of the ideals of liberty and democracy, would like to apologize for its 2001 through 2008 service outage. The technical fault that led to this 8-year service interruption has been located, and the software responsible was replaced on Tuesday night, November 4th. Early tests of this newly installed program indicate that we are now operating correctly, and we expect it to be fully functional by January 21st, 2009. We apologize for any inconvenience caused by the outage, and we look forward to resuming full service and hopefully even to improve it in years to come. Thank you for your patience and your understanding. Signed, the United States of America. There you go. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States and around the world. And by the way, Sean's going to be picking out her favorite post today, totally arbitrary, in our chat room, which you can get to at tomhartmann.com, and that person will receive an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So Colin in Pennsylvania. Hey, Colin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I really enjoyed your caller. I enjoyed your guest. I'm an English history buff. I spent 18 years over there because my family's from there, and so I know a bit about it. And I just thought I could put it kind of in plain terms, the relationship between the Puritans and the English Civil War.
Great. Basically,
if you can imagine the different branches of Protestantism that we have today. All this was going on during the English Reformation, and there were lots of disagreements as to what direction that they would take as far as the Church of England was concerned. And you can imagine the Puritans as a very, very intolerant and fundamentalist kind of branch.
Mm-hmm.
They worshipped very much the way I would compare them to fundamentalists that we see in Muslim, because that's how rigid they were in their beliefs. And
or people like the Westboro Baptist Church, you know, the ones who mistakenly read the Bible, and they run around with signs that say God hates fags, when in fact what the Bible says is that God hates figs. Jesus withered two fig trees. They don't have it right. Anyway, yeah. So by the way, this is all post Henry VIII and also post Martin Luther, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And they weren't so much, they were persecuted, but they were more ridiculed than persecuted, especially in Elizabethan times. In Elizabethan times, they were very anti-Shakespeare. They didn't like the plays. They thought they were rude. And as far as the Civil War is concerned, since the Civil War started out more as a power struggle between Parliament and the King, it went more theological because the guy who led the parliamentary forces, Oliver Cromwell, was a Puritan. And he did great damage over there while he was in power. He slaughtered thousands of people, not only in Ireland and Wales, but also in England itself. You know?
Yeah, my recollection was that was one of the reasons that the Puritans fled to the United States was because after Cromwell, they were widely hated in England.
No, not really, because really Cromwell was on their side.
Right, but after he was deposed or discredited.
Although
he's, you know, there's still a statue of him, you know, out in front of Parliament there, you know, Lord Protector Cromwell.
Well, you know what the Puritans did? They came over to America and burned all their women as witches, but over there they slaughtered thousands of non-believers and heretics that they called them heretics and stuff. So
very bizarre time.
I'm
Colin,
not a Puritan fan, so.
Yeah, there you go. Colin, what are you thankful for today?
What's that?
What are you thankful for today?
I'm not getting you very clearly, Tom. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. What are you thankful for today?
What am I thankful for today? I guess that I still have a reasonable job, and I am looking forward to spending time with my family. I guess that would be the most thing I'm thankful for is my family.
There you go.
And that I can still provide for them.
yep. Amen. Colin, thanks so much for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Ian in Sammamish, Washington?
Yes, Sammamish.
Sammamish. Okay.
Yeah.
Ian, what's up?
Right. Well, I was probably going to be slightly at odds with your last caller.
Okay.
As he said, the...
I would guess from your accent that you have a more intimate knowledge of this than I.
Yes, possibly. The whole of the beginning of the 1600s, there was the dispute between the Catholics and the Protestants.
Right.
And you had various monarchs who were leaning more back towards Catholicism.
Now, by Protestants, do you mean the Lutheran Protestants, or do you mean the Protestants who are following Henry VIII?
Various monarchs, I said, rather not Protestants. So you had James, Charles I was definitely heading the Church of England back towards Catholicism, and this was one of the things that brought up or led into the Civil War. There was also his taxation policies, which got somewhat creative. There was a, I think it was called the ship tax, which was levied on port towns so that they could fund the navy, and he sort of changed it so that anywhere within 100 miles of the sea was classed as a port town.
Right, now this is, you said John the First?
That's the whole country, basically.
You said this was John the First?
That was Charles the First.
So this is the John who signed the Magna Carta?
No, sorry, Charles the First.
Oh, Charles the First. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. So we're a couple hundred years later.
Yeah.
400 years later.
And so you then lead into the Civil War and the Cromwellian period.
Right.
Now, you know, there's this idea that the Puritans were the whole time beating up on other people. In fact, it was a period where there was quite a large religious tolerance. Cromwell actually was the first ruler in Britain to reopen synagogues for a number of hundred years. So there was, you know, rather than the Puritans holding power and dictating that everybody else should be a Puritan, there were many Protestant sects, there were other religions were allowed. The only people who were really persecuted were the Catholics.
Mm.
And as I say, because of the monarchy heading towards Catholicism, this was part of the reason for the Civil War.
Yeah.
Cromwell reigned until 1658 when he died, and then for a short period his son took over as ruler, and then in 1660 Charles II was returned to the throne.
Right.
And like many events, a lot of the history that we have of the initial sources are those written by those who won the eventual argument. So a lot of the early accounts of what happened in the 1650s under Cromwell were heavily flavored by the royalists once they got into power. And it's really
to make Cromwell look bad.
I'm saying he's not as black as he's painted.
Yeah.
And there are a number of modern British historians who have sort of been looking back at this. The name that springs to mind is a fellow called Christopher Hill, who's one of the books I did at university on this.
Right.
But you know, it's a classic case of, you know, the victors write the history.
Yeah, so this is, you know, much like there's still an ongoing and active debate in Germany over whether Marius van der Lubbe, the guy who torched the Parliament building,
yeah,
in 1932, was it, or 33, February 28th, as I recall.
Yeah, 33. Yeah,
whether he was working with the Nazis or whether he was just a demented Dutchman.
Yeah.
And there's a new history book out claiming that, no, he wasn't working with the Nazis. If he were, they would have gotten more of the artwork out of the building before it burned down.
Yeah.
In any case, we're still debating history here now 500 years later.
Yeah.
Or the British are. Fascinating. Ian, what are you thankful for today?
I'm getting to talk to you.
Oh, thank you very much. Ian, thanks a lot for the call. Moving along here. Steve in Portland. Hey, Steve, welcome to the show. What are you thankful for today?
Oh, you got all kinds of things, Tom. Too many to list. But I want to respond briefly to that cable from the United States of America apologizing for the power outage or the democracy outage of the last 8 years.
Right.
Well, you know, I thought that was a funny bit, but I would say that most of the United States history was a democracy outage as regards the rest of the world. I mean, if you look at all the imperialism and
we've had our bad times, Steve. I'll grant you that. But
yeah, I mean, I hear
this was particularly bad.
Standing as a moral leader over the last 8 years, but I would ask, when has the United States really been a moral leader? Maybe during World War II, but you know, look at all the situation as regards Latin America all throughout the 20th century, the Southeast Asian conflict.
You know, Steve, I recommend that you go back and read Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. He came over here in 1836 and spent 6 months traveling around the country, went back and wrote what became the best-selling book for the first 50 years of the 19th century.
Yeah.
And it inspired entire nations to become democratic after our Civil War, after they realized that we weren't going to fall apart and tear ourselves apart.
That was a long time ago, though.
It was. But my point is that I would say that literally, from our inception, we have been an inspiration to the rest of the world. I absolutely agree we have imperfectly acted out democracy, small d democracy, in many ways, but we get better all the time. And the last 8 years have been an aberration in that regard because we went backwards. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our number.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey there. You're a chicken. And I'm a turkey. And here is my love song just to you. Oh. I love your wings. I love your beak. You do those things. They're so unique. I love your eyes. The way you walk. I love your voice. The way you squawk. I'm so alone. Alone and blue.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And our crazy alert for the day. Yeah, this is pretty amazing. I'll tell you. Running over yourself while drunk driving. Yes, you heard it right. A 21-year-old man was spotted by the police, and they chased him into a ditch and through a barbed wire fence before stopping. He opened the door, thought he put the truck in a park, but actually put it in reverse, and as he fell out of the open door, the car went into reverse, or the pickup truck, and the left front wheel ran over both his legs. Not real right. Something about the Darwin Awards there might be appropriate. I don't know. Michael in Templeton, California. Michael, what are you thankful for today?
My family mainly, and the imminent departure of the criminal regime that's been in power for 8 years.
Amen.
I wanted to clear something up first. Cromwell was 1646 to 1653, and of course the Puritans were already here, a lot of them. Now, Mr. Davis said something interesting that resonates with me. He said that there were 20,000 Puritans that emigrated from 1630 on. I have ancestors that came here in 1638 from England, and they came as part of a church group. They all emigrated all together. Mm-hmm. And there was these two brothers that I'm descended from by the name of Peck, and I did some research on this years ago, and they originated in a town north of Manchester, Weldon, Weedon, something like that. But the name goes all the way back to the 11th century. And then they left from a port in the eastern part of England called Hinds, and then they came over and landed in Hingham, Massachusetts. And then 3 years later, I guess it was after King Philip's War, they went to Rhode Island and started a town that's still there. It's called Bristol, Rhode Island. Yeah. And so now Mr. Davis gives me some context that I didn't really have before, that maybe these people that I'm descended from, they came as part of this Puritan immigration that he's talking about that started in 1630, because these people came here in 1638.
Could be. And looking back at that time, I mean, thank you, Michael, for the call. And I just want to riff a little bit. This is actually from my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And the first Indian War in New England was the Pequot War of 1636. In which the colonists surrounded, this is, you know, back in the time of the first Thanksgiving, more or less, a little before that, I guess, but in which the colonists surrounded the largest of the Pequot villages, set it afire as the sun began to rise, and then performed their duty. They shot everybody, men, women, children, and the elderly, who tried to escape. As Puritan colonist William Bradford, yes, the William Bradford of the Shining City on the Hill speech, as Puritan colonist William Bradford described the scene, quote, "It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire and the streams of blood quenching the same, and horrible was the stink and scent thereof, but the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and the colonists gave praise thereof to God who had wrought so wonderfully." The Narragansetts, another tribe who typically had competed somewhat with the Pequots, up to that point had been friends of the colonists. They were so shocked by this particular example of European-style warfare that they refused further alliances with the whites. Captain John Underhill ridiculed the Narragansetts for their unwillingness to engage in genocide. And this is a quote from John Underhill in 1636. He said, quote, "Narragansett wars with other tribes are more for pastime than to conquer and subdue enemies," end quote. And in that, by the way, Underhill was correct. The Narragansett form of war, like that of most indigenous older culture people and almost all Native American tribes, did not have extermination of the opposition as a goal. After all, the neighbors are necessary to trade with, to maintain a strong gene pool through intermarriage, and to ensure cultural diversity. Most tribes wouldn't even want the lands of others because they'd have concerns about violating or entering the sacred or spirit-filled areas of other tribes. Even the killing of enemies is most often not the goal of tribal, so what we refer to as tribal wars. It's most often to fight to some predetermined measure of victory, such as seizing a staff, crossing a particular line, or the first wounding of the opponent, not killing. To count coup in most Indian wars meant to draw the first blood, not to kill. It could just be a scratch, and that person was out, and you got a feather. Jonathan in New York City. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hey, Mike, how are you? Tom, I've been listening to you for a long time listener. I just wanted to call in. I saw a special the other day, if I could get 30 seconds real quick. I saw a special on the Nazis raiding art of Europe when they were going into other countries and killing folks and trying to wipe out their civilization, all vestiges of their civilization. I'll start by saying I'm a patriot. First and foremost, I'm an African-American. I believe in the ideals of this country. But I've been listening for so long. This professor went on to recount how, you know, the stealing of all the art, a Jewish professor, he was talking about the stealing of all the art, and how this was the worst group of mass murderers in history. So I went out, I did a little homework, and, you know, you do the standard homework on how many Jews were killed during the Holocaust, and then I just happened to look into African Americans. I found estimates up to 18 million people doing the Atlantic slave trade. Sure. The Jewish professor was commenting. He was saying that never before in history have you had this kind of barbarism. He completely glossed over the entire thing in terms of, I understand it's pertinent to his experience, but this country, you know, he said, how can...
Well, hang on just a second here, Jonathan. I think that we all get it, that, you know, 18 million African Americans killed as a consequence of the slave trade, a terrible thing. 100 million Native Americans killed as the result of the colonization of North America. Arguably, the latter had to do with the manifest destiny. It was government policy. Arguably, the slave trade was government policy, but the Nazis were just explicitly trying to eliminate an entire people from the face of the earth. So while the numbers don't necessarily line up, I think that there is an important difference in the goal there. But it's all horrible.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, while we're thankful for so many things on this day before Thanksgiving here in the United States and other nations, I've been in, you know, when I lived in Germany, there was a Thanksgiving Day in Germany. It wasn't the same day. I know Canada has a different day. In any case, one of the things that I am, in addition to being thankful that the Bush administration is gone, I'm thankful for clear voices, for people who have clear vision, a deep understanding of the issues, and are willing to speak out. Scott Horton is one of those people. He has written in the current issue of Harper's Magazine, the December 2008 issue, a brilliant piece. I believe it's the cover story, as I recall. I tore the article out. I have just the article with me. I've got the magazine at home, but it's my recollection. It was the cover story. It's called Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration by Scott Horton. Scott is an attorney in New York, and he writes the daily weblog No Comment for Harper's.org. His last article was entitled Vote Machine, and it was in the March 2008 issue. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be with you.
Great to have you. I was so impressed by this. I wanted to get you on to highlight the story and get the meme out there as much as possible. In this story, or in this article, rather, you start out going through the many crimes of the Bush administration that are, by and large, not in dispute. You want to give us a quick summary of those?
Well, I think, you know, first and foremost, we have the surveillance program, the terrorist surveillance program, which involved going through the communications of tens of millions of Americans in violation of the FISA statute. In fact, we know the entire senior leadership of the Justice Department and the director of the FBI threatened to resign over that at one point because it was so outrageous. We have the meltdown of financial institutions and the way that this is being administered right now, you know, with the Inspector General of the Department of the Treasury saying he can't keep count of it. That's right. An interesting one. We have contracts being given out on a no-bid basis to incompetent contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan, totaling tens of billions of dollars. But all those are minor, I think, compared to the mistreatment of detainees in the detention program and the war on terror and the introduction of a torture program.
Right. And not just minor in a legal sense or a moral sense, but minor also in the sense of torture. There's an enormous body of law, both nationally, both domestically in the United States and internationally, that explicitly forbids torture. You could argue that in other countries, the Fourth Amendment, you know, the right to not have your phone tapped is not as clear or something like that. But, you know, most of the countries of the world have signed these treaties, from the Geneva Conventions to the United Nations, some of the founding documents of the United Nations to the specific treaties on torture. Treaties become the law of the land in the United States according to our Constitution. Plus, we have domestic laws against this. This is one of the areas where it's easiest to say, here's proof that these guys actually broke the law, and here's the law, right?
And it's foundational value for the United States, going back to 1776 when our first commander-in-chief, not yet president, George Washington, issued orders that George Bush, in fact, overturned. Abraham Lincoln in 1863 issued orders on these subjects. So
right.
These are very, very deep-rooted American values before we even get to the question of international law.
Right, and in both cases, George Washington and Abraham Lincoln both declaring torture to be verboten, and both of them saying that prisoners of war should be treated with respect and civility.
That's right.
And in fact, Washington was pretty explicit about it. He said that the reason to do this is to show the world who we are.
That's exactly right. For him, this would define what our republic was all about. That soldiers were human beings too, that they were citizens, and that we would have a military of citizen soldiers, and therefore we were going to respect people who were engaged in combat, which is completely contrary to the tradition of the European powers up to that point, where people who fought were just so much cannon fodder.
Right, and torture was routinely engaged in. In fact, the British engaged in torture against us, against our soldiers, back in that day in the Revolutionary War. And the War of 1812 as well, The consequences of inaction, the second point in your article, we're talking to Scott Horton, it's the cover story, isn't it, Scott?
I
picked it up on the airplane coming back from the Air America cruise and thought, this is amazing, and I tore it out and stuck it in my pocket, and I don't know what happened to the magazine now. I subscribed to Harper's in part because the last couple issues have been just so brilliant. And it's been a few years, and I don't subscribe to a lot because I'm so overwhelmed with email and mail and everything else, you know. But this is a great magazine. And this is called Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. Your second point is the consequences of inaction. And I would say that this goes all the way back in some ways to Jerry Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon, to Bill Clinton's decision not to prosecute the Iran-Contra crimes of George Herbert Walker Bush and the Reagan administration. But it's even larger than that.
That's right. I mean, our system operates on the basis of precedent. So when you have a president do some things and get away with it, he bears no consequences for that, then that is established as a precedent that can be followed by future presidents. So if we just walked away and ignore this, you're essentially saying that we have Barack Obama right now. He's made clear what he's going to do. But the president who succeeds him could completely reverse this and go back to following the precedent that was established by Bush. So this issue, it's not really about retribution
for individuals. It's really about establishing and upholding principles. And the first of those principles is the rule of law. That is, the president, when he's sworn in, must abide by and uphold the law.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so the consequences of an inaction are...
And the consequences of inaction mean that that option is left on the table for future presidents. And to put it in different terms, we also have to think about that American pilot who gets shot down in the war in the next generation, and who's sitting in a prison cell. And is he going to be tortured or is he going to be mistreated? One of the rules is that if you don't abide by the prohibition on torture, and humane treatment of prisoners, then the people who fight for you are not entitled to those protections. Right. So it's really a question of protecting that American soldier, that American pilot or airman in a future engagement.
We're talking with attorney and author Scott Horton, who wrote a brilliant piece, Justice After Bush, in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. And you lay out how this prosecution might be done, how, you know, the areas where it's really pretty politically impossible and the areas where it's politically practical. How do we do this?
Well, I don't think there's really any question of prosecuting the people at the bottom line, the CIA agents or military people who've applied the techniques. The question is the accountability of the people who made the policy and issued the orders for this to happen. And the problem we have is that the Justice Department itself was deeply enmeshed in this whole process, which means that they really can't do the internal inquiry or bring the prosecution. So I suggest that there's a way out now, and that's to have a commission of inquiry, to let this commission take its time, to allow it to lay bare all the facts so that the people understand exactly what happened, who did what, and then we can make some decisions about what shape specific individual accountability should take. And that may be pardons issued by the president, or it may be prosecutions, and most likely it's going to be a combination of both of those things.
Right, and is this the hybrid solution that you wrap up the article with?
That's right. It's a presidential commission, and from what I understand right now, President-elect Obama is considering this as one of several alternatives. I think it's pretty clear that they're not going to go immediately having the Justice Department do a criminal probe for reasons that I explained in the article. So the clear alternative for them is this commission approach, either a presidential commission or a hybrid congressional presidential commission, which would require special legislation.
Right. What are the reasons, Scott Horton, that you lay out in the article about why a criminal probe wouldn't be appropriate? We have about a minute left here, by the way.
Well, I mean, we know that a bank was robbed, but we don't know exactly who did what. So we can't begin with charges immediately. And I think we've had an administration over the last several years that's always jumped the gun and rushed into things. This is a matter where we need to treat things consequently, take our time, fully develop the facts, develop public support for some sort of action, and then the criminal justice process can kick in.
Right. Sort of the way that they built the case against Bill Clinton, frankly. I mean, you know, it's step by step, deep investigations, lots of testimony, lots of, you know, it becomes, or probably a better example, the way that they built the case against Richard Nixon.
Well, you build the facts first.
Right.
I think the criminal justice action can only follow the full exposure of the facts.
Right. So we need the equivalent of the grand jury hearings, as it were, or whatever. Scott Horton, his article in the current issue of Harper's, it's really worth going out and getting a copy of Harper's to read this, among all the other great things in Harper's. Justice After Bush, Prosecuting an Outlaw Administration. Scott, thanks so much for writing this, and thanks for dropping by today.
And happy Thanksgiving to you and your listeners.
Thank you, and the same to you, sir. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour, the place where conservatives come to party. Fox News has been shut out from the Obama press conferences. Here's another thing to be thankful for. Fishbowl DC notes that Fox News has not been allowed to ask a question at any of the four press conferences that Barack Obama has held since winning the election. Obama spokesman Robert Gibbs says there's nothing nefarious going on. He says, I would tell him, get a good question and say, stay tuned. Mm-hmm. The Washington Times reports that Obama has granted an unprecedented bit of access for reporters who have grown accustomed to President Bush's infrequent moments taking questions and already surpassed the last four presidents in waiting. So, and Obama had a response, by the way, to those people who are saying, hey, wait a minute, you've got a bunch of people here who've been in office before, and, you know, that you're appointing to these positions, a lot from the Clinton administration, and doesn't this mean that we're not going to really have change and all this kind of stuff? Fawaz Shakir, writing over at thinkprogress.org, he points out that Barack Obama says, no, you know, this is going to come from me. He says, but understand where the vision for change comes from. First and foremost, it comes from me. That's my job, is to provide a vision in terms of where we're going and to make sure that my team is implementing it. So he's hiring people who know how to get things done, who know how to use the bureaucracy, who know where the levers are of power, who know how to make the country work. But he's the one who's going to be telling them what to do. Good on. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jim in Burbank, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to say that, all Holocausts, whether it's the American Indian or the Jewish or the African American, they're all government policy just like wars are. And to think that, like a war, to think that, it's any semblance of respect can be given anyone involved in a war or a Holocaust, such as your last, Horton here's a who guy, suggesting that soldiers can be given respect, is he's mired in the same oxymoronic logic that allows wars to be sold to the people of the world. Wars are all immoral. They are, none of them are justified because they are all preventable. And the reason why we did this last war was because the preventability was there, but they had to lie, make up a lie to get us into it. And
you know, broadly, Jim, your premise that war is legalized mass murder is right, and that it's wrong, and that it generally lacks moral justification is right. That you almost never see anything that looks like it in most of the animal kingdom, and frankly, among most Aboriginal indigenous people, if you would make that point, would be correct. But I'm just curious, in 1935. How would you have stopped World War II, or would you have simply let Hitler take over all of Europe?
Oh, I wouldn't have. I wouldn't have supported him by doing business with him, by allowing him to grow.
No, I understand that, but our support of Hitler, you know, it was pretty minor.
You know,
yes, George Bush's
a,
grandfather
sure,
was involved
sure,
in it, all
I'm
that kind
a,
of stuff,
I'm
but
not a scholar
we did not.
Like you may be.
I beg your pardon?
I am not a scholar like you may be about all the unknowns in the past of how to prevent Hitler. But in terms of human nature, I am an expert because I am one. And if you do not allow people to get away with stuff, as we've allowed Bush and maybe we're going to be allowing Obama to get away with things, then they will grow in stature and size and end up being a Hitler.
No, it's happening right now in Zimbabwe with Mr. Mugabe. It's happening right now in Sudan with Bashir, with Hafez al-Bashir. And he has been, in fact, charged by the United Nations along with his right-hand man, his equivalent of the Secretary of State, with crimes against humanity, with genocide for what's going on in Darfur. But it really looks like, and Congo is melting down right now. 5 million people have died in the Congo in the last mm-hmm. few years, a consequence of what appears to be a spreading of the Hutu-Tutsi conflict that started in Rwanda two decades ago. How do you stop these things once they become militarized? Once Hitler builds his military and starts marching from country to country and systematically putting to death all the people that oppose him, and including entire groups of people like Catholics, Jews, and Gypsies, how do you stop them if not by war?
The way you stop it is to stop doing what you've done to bring it up to the where it's at.
What have we done to bring about what's going on in Zimbabwe right now?
in Zimbabwe and Africa, all the types of I hear about the natural resources that people squabble over, whether it's China squabbling over
Zimbabwe is not, you know, it may be rich in natural resources, but this is not a resource war in Zimbabwe. This is, you know, Robert Mugabe is just a crazy man. He has become a crazy man.
If you think that Zimbabwe doesn't have a resource to squabble over, then I suggest that you're wrong.
No, I agree with you. They do have resources, but those mines are not operating right now.
Mm-hmm.
Zimbabwe, by and large, has shut down and fallen apart. It's become a military dictatorship. What do you do if you don't march in with guns when you've got
you
guys
cooperate
with guns?
With them. You just look.
So your strategy is just stand back and let them do what they're doing.
Gasoline on the fire, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Jim, I respectfully disagree with you. And as much as I hate war, I quit eating meat when I was 17 years old as a statement of pacifism. I still acknowledge that sometimes it is necessary, in my opinion. 27 minutes past that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
A quick summary on some of the things in the news here. Bush drinking again. He's downing pisco sours in Peru. Maybe it was a virgin pisco. We don't know. Congress is going to try and figure out if Elliot Spitzer was targeted. You will recall about 2 years ago, Elliot Spitzer wrote a scathing, I read it in its entirety here on the show about 6 months ago, a scathing op-ed piece for either the New York Times or the Washington Post. I'm pretty sure it was the Washington Post. Pointing out that this whole subprime thing was criminal behavior on the part of the banks, and that he, as the attorney general for the state of New York, had the legislature had passed a law against it, and he was trying to enforce it, and the Bush administration had to go back to a Civil War era authority that the federal government had to stop states from enforcing their own laws to prevent the very, very large number of states that had passed laws against predatory lending to continue the practice of subprime mortgages. Spitzer laid this out. He laid it out. He pointed the finger of blame right at the Bush administration. This is long before the collapse. Pointed the finger of blame right at the Bush administration and said, this is going to produce a disaster. So the question now is, did they track him down with his little hooker friend as part of political payback? Congress is going to look into this. California is going to probe the Mormon Church's role in the Prop 8 campaign. Have they violated their nonprofit status? That should be very entertaining. Ann Coulter's jaw has been wired shut. She has, just as she has a new book out, saying essentially, it's called Guilty, saying essentially, well, you know, the media was too nice to Barack Obama. Yeah, all those days they played Reverend Wright. Does that recall it was 7 days in a row? Amazing. Amazing. No defined role yet for Joe Biden. That's something that I'm keeping an eye out. I think that's going to be very interesting. You know, exactly what role is Biden going to play in the administration? The bailout now, we're looking at over $4 trillion. Keep in mind the GDP of the United States is about $15 trillion total the entire year, all domestic, all economic activity. $4 trillion, more than the Louisiana Purchase, more than the Marshall Plan, more than the Vietnam War combined. It's really quite remarkable. The Iraqi parliament is delaying a vote on U.S. troop withdrawal. So let's keep an eye on that. These are just some of the things we ought to keep an eye on Barbara Bush is resting comfortably after ulcer surgery. If I had George as a son, I would have ulcers too, I got to tell you. The former ambassador from Georgia says what I have been saying from day one. As soon as I learned that Karl Rove was meeting with Mikhail Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, 3 weeks before the bombing started, and that John McCain's number one foreign policy advisor, Randy Shuneman, was taking millions of dollars, $800,000, I think it was, from Saakashvili, I knew that that war was not started by Russia. It was started by Georgia, and it was started by Georgia to help John McCain's campaign. Vladimir Putin said that in those blunt terms after the fact. I was saying it, and now the ambassador from Georgia says it. So, and the Obamas say they're not going to get a girly dog. Yeah, and Paul Volcker. This guy, I think Paul Volcker has something to do with the pigeons. This guy is like 12 feet tall. He's over 80 years old. He could probably still play basketball. The guy is a mutant. He's a good mutant, but I think that he's got some relation to the pigeons. Gotta be. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Jim in Portland, what are you thankful for today?
Hey, you stole my thunder. I was going to call and say that I'm thankful that Ann Coulter's jaw got wired shut.
That's a good one. I'm thankful for that, too. We're not going to have to debate whether or not we put her on the air here on this show. The
monster has been silenced, albeit temporarily.
There you go. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Gary in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. The normally cynical me has to share with you a socialized medicine story.
Okay.
It's the VA, and the VA has come through for my father, who is post-infection, pneumonia, and all the rest has required a lot of care. And the private nursing home basically read us the riot act last week, telling us he'll need to give up his home, his pension, his compensation, and his livelihood to the home. And the VA came rushing in, because he's a World War II POW, and said, we will cover all compensation. You put him in a different place and we'll fix it. So we're able to stay in the same hometown. So despite all the criticism, the brokenness of the VA, it is still the system that can take care of its own. And I think we still need it.
So what you're grateful for today, Gary, is the socialized medicine system we have in the United States known as the Veterans Administration Medical System.
You bet. It prevented financial destitution on this very week for my father.
That's great. And we'll hear from Larry Scott about that in the next hour. Thank you very much, Gary. Appreciate the call. Sean in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Sean, what are you thankful for today?
Oh, because Obama was elected.
Good.
It was the greatest day of my life.
It was pretty spectacular, wasn't it?
Listen, what I wanted to ask you as a favor, Tom, people need to really not forget and get very comfortable about the fact that Republicans got us where we are.
Yes.
And justice needs to be made. You know what I mean? If we compromise, we are screwed all over again. We can't do that. You know what I mean?
Agree.
We have to ask for that. But one more thing. You know, these churches are the mouthpiece of the Republicans. Every time they want something done, they come up with the abortion issue and so forth, and that's how they rumble and get people together to vote for that issue so they can direct them for their best interest. And I think these churches, 501c3, nonprofit organizations, should be taken away from them, period.
Yeah. Sean, I am entirely in favor of putting more of a firewall in there and saying that, first of all, it's not all Christians who are doing that. The United Church of Christ has been very, very active in, for example, embracing gays in their congregations and pushing back against the war. But right across the board, and for that matter, the United Methodist Church, which I was raised in and which Dick Cheney and George Bush are both members of, that church came out and denounced the war in Iraq and the invasion of Iraq. So it's not all Christians, but you're right. There are some who are badly misusing this. And the fact that Pat Robertson is worth $1 billion today, and he got it all with a nonprofit organization, should tell you that there's something seriously wrong with the way this so-called system is working. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Julian, what are you thankful for today?
Well, I'm thankful for your show, Tom.
Oh, well, thank you, Julian.
Yeah, okay. I had a question. Your guest wanting to do investigations and prosecutions.
Right.
Is Bush likely to issue pardons for most of the people in his administration? And is it possible that he can pardon himself?
Good question. And I don't know the answer to either of those. We had John Dean on once, and we got into a rather long and detailed discussion of this. And I'm not sure that we ever got to a clear answer about whether a president can pardon himself. My recollection is that it's something that hasn't been tested by the Supreme Court, that the pardon power in the Constitution does not exempt a president from powering himself, so theoretically it's possible, but it probably would end up before the Supreme Court. He certainly can pardon anybody else. It's the one kingly power that a president has. And will he issue pardons for the criminals in his administration? I certainly expect it. But I don't think that that should prevent us from investigating their crimes, exposing their crimes, just like I think it shouldn't have prevented us from investigating Nixon and his buddies and their crimes and exposing their crimes. I mean, we need to have a cleansing, a healing in this nation from, you know, just this awful stuff that has happened. Paula in Carbondale, Illinois, listening on WINI, one of our first and favorite affiliates. Hey, Paula.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to take exception to your belief that the United States is a force for good and justice. When you're talking about Rwanda, to quote the Organization of African Unity, they said, throughout the genocide, American machinations at the Security Council repeatedly undermined all attempts to strengthen the UN military presence in Rwanda. And Secretary General Brutus Ghali said, it was one thing for the United States to place conditions on its own participation in UN peacekeeping. It was something else entirely for the U.S. to attempt to impose its conditions in other countries, which is what Madeleine Albright did. And the U.S. effort to prevent the effective deployment of a UN force for Rwanda succeeded with the strong support of Britain. So the international community did little or nothing as the killing in Rwanda continued. And that means that the United States wanted the Tutsis to take over. They've backed them ever since, and they've backed them when they've invaded the Congo. So for you to imply that the United States can go in and stop genocide when the United States is actually backing genocide is totally backwards.
Yeah. In this case, you're absolutely right, Paula. This was a huge failing of the Clinton administration.
It wasn't. You could say failing. That's the way it's spun now. Oh, we didn't do anything. Yeah, we did do something. We stopped the UN from intervening.
You're right.
I just wanted to say one more thing. Hello?
And I'm not going to try and put any lipstick on that pig. You're absolutely right.
No, I just wanted to say one thing about World War II. If the United States would have wanted to stop the genocide, they could have bombed the railroad lines without killing anybody. But
yes.
They didn't do that. They didn't bomb the factories. They didn't bomb the railroad lines. They, you know, they bombed Dresden and killed 100,000 people.
Right.
So,
or we could have bombed those places where we knew that Hitler was living or hanging out. I mean,
exactly.
You know, there was this rule of kings. You know, you don't kill the king, you kill the soldiers. And you know, just like in Japan, we could have bombed the emperor's palace. And it never happened. We need to rethink war in a lot of ways. Paul, thank you for the call.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Not be pretty, and my clothes are not the best, and there ain't no big shots in my family tree. But if you're wondering who it was that made this country great, you don't have to look no further, it was me. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track, I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars, and I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
Indeed. And not only that, here, I just have to share this with you. David Letterman, Sarah Palin. I am thankful for Sarah Palin, I have to say. I confess. It was comic relief. Frankly, I think if George Romney, or Mitt Romney rather, George was his father. I was a kid in Michigan when George was governor of Michigan. If Mitt Romney had been on the ticket, for example, with John McCain, I think that it would have been a whole lot tighter race, frankly. And it might have even gone the other way, although I frankly doubt it, but nonetheless, it would have been a hell of a lot tighter race. And so Sarah Palin, you know, we all owe a debt of gratitude to her. David Letterman knocking it out of the park last
night.
Here
now, Sarah Palin's top 10 excuses. So saddle up and ride here.
Now, this is for having the turkey slaughtered behind her as she's being interviewed while she's pardoning one.
Here we go. Number 10, I can see Russia, but I can't see what's going on 5 feet behind me. Number 9, not thinking straight after spending all night reading every newspaper and magazine. Number 8, damn, gotcha media got me again. Number 7, my Remington shotgun says I don't need an excuse. Number 6, those were Al-Qaeda turkeys. Those were Al-Qaeda turkeys, ladies and gentlemen. Number 5, I thought they were just torturing the little guy. Number 4, I mean, doggone it, you know, like we have to lower taxes and like it all falls under job security and we need to drill, you know? Number 3, stomach flu? Number 2, I'll get right back to you. I'm still adorable, America. And Sarah Palin's number one excuse. Don't blame me. Blame Joe the turkey slaughterer. There you go.
There you go. David Letterman, CBS, just a great job. And Sarah Palin, the rumors are that she's going to go down to Georgia and campaign for Max, or not, for Saxby Chambliss. You know, how sad is that? It's going to be interesting, actually, if she helps or hurts. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. David in Santa Cruz, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I'm grateful today for the revolutionary truth-tellers in times of universal deceit. Truth-telling is a revolutionary act.
Yeah, to quote George Orwell.
We've had many people stand up to what I believe are domestic enemies of the United States that are in power illegitimately and have conspired to subvert the will of Congress by signing statements and have violated the Posse Comitatus Act by activating 3 military units containing upwards of 20,000 military personnel in the United States. And people like General Kevin Burns, number 5 in command, 4-star general who is alleged with his subordinates to have single-handedly stopped a false flag terror attack in the United States in order to attack Iran, much like 9/11 was. And I really hope that Obama is able to support the Congress in filing a law that will investigate the crimes of the Bush administration and no holds barred, because it's, you know, events like 9/11 could happen much bigger and much worse unless we actually get to the truth of what the first responders experienced. And the 9/11 Truth Movement, a911truth.org, has ample proof. We have professionals there that can prove to the American people that this World Trade Complex was destroyed with controlled demolition.
There are too many questions that not only have not been answered, but frankly, in the mainstream, the corporate media have not even been asked. David, great. Thank you very much. And so much to be thankful for. Alan in Kenmare, Washington. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Oh, nothing much. I recently was...
What are you thankful for today?
Okay. Well, I used to take some constitutional law back in the day, and then I was just recently speaking to an attorney who was on the Rachel Maddow show, who's a constitutional expert. Mm-hmm. And according to him, the Constitution reads... well, it does, actually. It says the president shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. That means that the states themselves, who have states' rights, can bring criminal charges against every single one of the people in the Bush organization, up to and including murder. And then those states themselves would have the right to extradite to anywhere in the world that might wish to present any other charges against them.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Including Texas right now is already bringing charges. There's a court in Texas that has brought charges against Dick Cheney. I'm not sure where that's gone, but I know of. I'm pretty active in politics, and a lot of attorneys generals, from what I understand, are kind of playing with it and seeing what's going to happen.
Yeah, there was a woman running for attorney general in Vermont on the Green Party ticket, as I recall, or maybe the Progressive Party ticket, whose claim to fame was that she was going to prosecute George W. Bush for murder if she was elected. She was not elected. But this is going viral. This thing that and thank you for that, Alan. This thing that Vince Bugliosi has put out there with his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, and I think it's a good solid one. Dorothy in Raymond, Washington. Hey, Dorothy, got a minute before we got to wrap up the hour? What's up?
Oh, hi. Well, I'm thankful for Democracy Now! To bring us the real news.
step by step here.
What I was going to ask you when you were talking about war, what you thought of Obama keeping Gates on when Karzai is anxious to, you know, he's asked the Egyptians to help him bring peace to that country. And
I think Karzai's about had it with us. And with regard to Gates as Secretary of Defense, I'm really torn. I mean, on the one hand, I see when you are involved in these kinds of conflicts, some significant importance in maintaining continuity, and particularly if after Obama is sworn in, there's another terrorist attack on the United States, or something goes south in a big way, whether it's, for example, Israel bombs the nuclear reactors in Iran, or whether it's Iraq blows up in our face, or Afghanistan. If Obama has put in somebody other than Gates or immediately, not only would that person be dealing with a disaster, you know, not only would they really have their hands full and not know how, you know, where all the levers of power are in the Defense Department, but also they'd be blamed for it. So I think that probably this is a good move, and Gates seems like a reasonable guy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, many years ago, long ago and far away, I wrote in a book, entitled The Prophet's Way, about some of my experiences in India. I remember in the early 80s, staying at the Taj Palace Hotel. At the time, Louise and I owned a travel business, International Wholesale Travel in Atlanta, and we could get, you know, I could stay at pretty much any fancy hotel in the world for pennies. And I was there to negotiate for some land for an orphanage on behalf of Kinder and Eugen Hilsberg Salem, the International Salem Organization, this child care organization. And I remember one morning, this is a very, very nice hotel right on the waterfront. And every time you walk out the door, you'd be surrounded by beggars and kids. And it was, as is the case pretty much anywhere in India, but this was in what was then called Bombay. It's now called Mumbai. And I remember watching as a flatbed truck came down the road. And there was a bunch of kids in the back of the flatbed truck. And this guy would hop out and he'd put a blanket on a corner and he'd pick one of the kids out of the truck. And I saw that the kid didn't have any legs or was missing one of his legs. He set him on the blanket, put a bowl in front of him, and then drive two blocks down and do it again. They were putting these kids out as vending machines. This was the local mafia. So, anyhow, I wrote about that in the book, but it was at the Taj Palace Hotel. Just minutes ago, the Taj Palace Hall, I've been there. I've slept there a number of times. Was attacked, along with the Oberoi Hotel, which I've also stayed at. Was attacked, we don't know by whom, but breaking news out of India that something's going on there. Something's going on. We'll see. Jeff Golden has written a fascinating novel. You want to escape from the real world for a little bit and experience what the world might have been if Jack Kennedy hadn't been assassinated. President Kennedy famously said, "A nation that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood in an open market is a nation that is afraid of its people." That quote on the cover of Jeff's book, Unafraid, a novel of the possible. The website Unafraid, the book. Jeff Golden, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on.
Jeff, how would the world have been? You're welcome, and thank you, and happy Thanksgiving Day to you, by the way, tomorrow. How would the world have been different, in your opinion and in your book, had John Kennedy not been successfully assassinated, had there merely been an attempt?
Well, there's those might be two different answers, what I think and what's in my book, because there's a pivotal piece in the book that he's shot in Dallas in my book, but survives. John Connolly's actually killed. The bullets wander a little from the historical path. And that experience, that near-death experience, like as happens with many people, changes him profoundly. He actually goes to Thomas Merton for spiritual mentorship. And he, his
Thomas Merton, for people who don't know, is a relatively famous Catholic monk and a brilliant writer. His book, The Little Birds of Zen, as I recall the title, was one of my favorites back in the 80s. He's written a number of just extraordinarily thought-provoking and insightful books on contemplation and spirituality.
And John Kennedy read him in his life and had some influence, part of the interesting complexity of John F. Kennedy.
Uh-huh.
But at any rate, with
in his
that
real
mentor,
life.
Yeah, his real life. The experience, near-death experiences, first of all, causes him to become more successful and popular than any president's ever been. A little bit of that Ronald Reagan phenomenon when Ronald Reagan got shot, plus his own skills. So he's got anything he wants breezing through Congress. He's got 90% approval ratings in the book. A parade of the world's most beautiful women traveling through the White House with impunity. So that by our model of success, traditionally, he has it all. And his reaction to that is, this can't be all there is. This is vanity. I'm just caretaking a ship on its way to oblivion here. This doesn't make sense. I'm going to use my time here to see what I can do with this country. How far can I nudge its walk towards its talk?
So he has an Ecclesiastes moment.
Yeah. So in that sense, it's not a straight line projection like others have done, looking at the historical record and trying to extrapolate what he most likely would have done. It has that bump, that transformation that makes him a leader who's liberated from most of the conventional constraints that our consultants have put on our political leadership. So that's a twist in answering your question. But I'm, the context that question most often gets asked in is Vietnam. What would have happened there? And there's been some good scholarship on that. But as I researched this, and I didn't know this, but Kennedy was as involved as any member of Congress, both as a representative and a senator, in Southeast Asia. He went there, I think, 3 times while he was in Congress. He wrote about it fairly extensively, gave some speech on the House floor. And I don't think there's much question but that he would have withdrawn pretty quickly from Southeast Asia in the second term. There is some data to the other effect. But basically, I guess I'd like to say what I'm afraid is, it isn't so much the what-if story. That's kind of a vehicle to talk about expanding our notion of what's possible in politics and exploring what kind of leadership we're ready for. What would happen to a transformational leader? Would we be ready for him? That's more what the book's about than kind of speculation about what Kennedy would do in a second term.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff, Jeff. The book, Unafraid, by Jeff Golden, a novel of the possible. There's a long lineage of these sorts of books. You know, what would have happened if Hitler had been assassinated? What would have happened if Hitler had won? You know, there's some great ones out there. You've contributed to the genre tremendously. Jeff, thanks for dropping by today.
Good. Tom, could I invite people to read excerpts of the book at unafraidthebook.com?
You may, and you just did.
I did. Thanks for your time. Happy Thanksgiving, Tom.
Thank you, and the same to you, Jeff. Thank you very much. Great to hear from you, and good luck with the book. Unafraidthebook.com is the website. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dave in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom.
And what are you thankful for?
Huh?
And what are you thankful for?
I am thankful for Governor Palin. I have to admit that I agree with you. Governor Palin, it was a treat for all liberals and progressives alike.
Well said.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, sir. Well, how does a woman who talked about how Senator Obama wanted to wave the white flag of surrender have the guts to go campaign down in Georgia for a man who ruined Max Cleveland's life?
Because she's shameless. Because she's ignorant. And I don't mean that by way of, like, you know, insulting her. I mean that as a purely pure statement of analysis. She was running around the country during this campaign saying things that led to an upsurge in literally death threats, race-based death threats against Barack Obama and other African Americans. She was doing this just, you know, blitheringly, blindly. Somebody had to be telling her it was going on. But she's sufficiently shameless that she didn't give a damn, A, and she's sufficiently ignorant about how the country works and the history of this country, whether it's because she was born in Alaska, never left the state for any, you know, in any meaningful way. Although, actually, she spent a lot, you know, she went to college in Idaho, I guess, so.
Yeah,
you know, yeah,
she did. Several Idaho colleges.
Yeah, exactly, five different, and she went to college in Hawaii, too, as I recall. But, yeah. You know, the bottom line here is I just, you know, the gift of Sarah Palin is also the tragedy of Sarah Palin, and that is that it's blind ambition and shameless and not all that bright, and that would be why she would be going to Georgia.
Well, I thank you for everything you do. I love listening to you all the time, and I wish you and your family and friends a happy Thanksgiving. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave, and the same to you and yours. Tim in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tom. What I'm thankful for is your chat room.
Oh, great. What's your name in the chat room?
Actually, what happened was that about 2 years ago, I was at my parents' place, and I was trying to rebuild a fence. About 2 years ago on 4th of July. Well, I fell and I broke my elbow, and at the time I didn't have insurance, so
ouch.
I was in pain, and I was at the chat room, and I said, what do? I don't have insurance. So there was Taraza said that, why don't you go to the Catholic health worker? And the rest of the members who were inside there were chatting away with me. They said, yeah, they'll help you. If you don't have money, don't worry about it, blah, blah, blah. So I went there, got treated, and then after I got treated, they told me to go to the county USC Medical Hospital. And I said, but I don't have insurance. He said, don't worry about it. You don't have to pay for it. Single payer. I'm like, well, okay. So I went to the county, got x-rayed, got my prescription, and got therapy, and my elbow's a lot better. And I want to thank everyone in that chat room because
wow.
of that.
What a great testimonial. Well, Tim, thank you very much. Thanks for participating.
Thank you, Tom. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, and the same to you, Tim. And our chat room, of course, as it has been for 6 years now, totally free. Fully available 24/7, although the time I hang out in there is noon to 3 Eastern time when we're doing this show live. And you can get there by going to TomHartmann.com and just click the chat link right up at the top. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
The show brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our show, supporting your local radio station, supporting our advertisers. Give them a call. Let them know you're listening. Let them know that you support them. And, you know, if you have some meaningful way to do it, do that, too. Particularly the advertisers. Buy their products, send people to them. It's what keeps it all going. These are strange times. It's a difficult economy we're going into, and we all need to be looking out for each other. Speaking of looking out for each other, that's what the VA is all about, looking out for our servicemen and women. And Larry Scott runs the very finest website on the entire Internet for veterans, families of veterans, people involved in veterans issues, anybody who wants to know anything about veterans issues, VAWatchdog.org. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tom, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Well, thank you very much, and happy Thanksgiving to you as well. VA auditors and employees are tampering with electronic files for disability claims. Is this another Bushism or something, or is this just the occasional bad apple employee, or what's going on?
Well, it's kind of a bureaucracy run wild. This started a number of weeks ago, and we broke the story about veterans' claims and critical documents being found in shredder bins. And at the same time, we'd also heard that there was the possibility of file tampering. And sure enough, the VA's Office of Inspector General went into the New York Regional Office. That's the office where veterans will file claims in the general New York City area. And they found that over 56% of the claims had been tampered with electronically, mainly what they called backdating, adjusting dates on them and so forth. They removed the six top employees there, And from the initial reports, this is evidently a way of life at that office and a number of other VA regional offices around the country. The Office of Inspector General is investigating, and we should have a report out in a few days about how widespread this is and what problems it's actually caused to veterans in the processing of their disability claims applications.
Amazing. You know, the Bush administration has altered the, and the White House website on whitehouse.gov, they have altered the original pages, the original documents, the ones that are dated 2002 and 2003. They have altered them to show different numbers in different countries for the coalition of the billing.
Mm-hmm.
They're literally rewriting the history of the Iraq War, and they're not noting that they are making the changes. They're simply making the changes. So somebody, if a historian went in and tried to look at those documents, thinking they were looking at original documents, they would be looking at altered documents. It seems like this is coming from the top down, at least in terms of culture.
And what's happening here, too, the culture we have here is that monies have been cut over the last 8 years for the offices of Inspector General in almost every government agency. Also, excuse me, I'm trying to catch my Thanksgiving cold here.
Yeah.
Monies have been
cut. I've got one.
Yeah, monies have been cut for the Government Accountability Office as well. So we have fewer investigators, fewer investigations, and fewer people watching what is actually going on in these government agencies, and that includes the VA, unfortunately.
Right. What are your thoughts? We're talking with Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, his website, the best VA website out there. If you don't check VA Watchdog regularly, you don't know what's going on with the VA. What are your thoughts on the new veterans, the new VA secretary? There's been no announcement. I have not even heard any, you know, hints or anything. Have you?
Well, you know, the Associated Press has been doing this kind of cabinet level survey every day where they have names on this list. Who's under consideration? Who's under consideration? And for the last week or so, there have been four names on there, including the current VA secretary, Dr. James Peake, which is kind of disturbing to veterans.
That's
because
kind of
a lot of bad things have happened on his watch. Yesterday, his name fell off the list. The Associated Press has voted him off the island for some reason. We're not quite sure what's going on there, but believe me, the AP reporters have their ears to the ground, and if Peake's not on that list, he's probably not under consideration. Right now, there are just three names, and that is Iraq War veteran Tammy Duckworth, who is the head of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. There's also former Senator Max Cleland, who is a decorated Vietnam veteran, and Cleland was also head of the VA a number of years ago before it became a cabinet-level agency. And the third one is a fairly recent name on the list, and that's Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown of Maryland, who has served in the Iraq War. He's a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve, and they think a very, very progressive-thinking young man who would probably bring a lot of good qualities to the VA. Right now, the way it's lined up is it looks like Duckworth sits on top and then Brown and then Cleveland is kind of the way people are thinking.
Hmm. Well, that's not a bad list. I mean,
it is an excellent list, as a matter of fact. And although, you know, the veterans will come onto VAWatchdog.org and in our comments section, you know, they'll make comments pro or con on the various candidates for the new VA secretary. Nobody can really find anything wrong with these three people.
Right.
They would all bring a lot of strength to the office, and they would all be good progressive thinkers who would want to make great changes in the way the VA is
That's
run.
Great. We just have just maybe 15 seconds left, Larry. The government shows, new report shows the Gulf War syndrome is real.
The Gulf War syndrome is absolutely real. A commission that was put in effect by Congress says it is real. It was the pesticides and the experimental drugs they were using. The VA is going to have to act on this very, very soon, Tom.
Good. I'm glad to hear that they've, you know, finally after all these, what, almost two decades they've gotten this
That's
together.
Right, 91.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Check it out. Larry, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And happy Thanksgiving. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
866-303-2270. And who's gonna pay the bill? Who's gonna pay the bill? not Rush Limbaugh, not George Will, not those chicken hawks on Capitol Hill, not the tax cut billionaires. You know the drill. You're gonna pay the bill.
This is the amazing thing. We're over $4 trillion now in aggregate, all the money that has been thrown at this so-called bailout. $4 trillion. You know, the entire GDP of the United States is $15 trillion, more or less. So it's almost a third of everything we produce in 1 year. Actually, in 6 months. And I guarantee you there's a whole bunch of fat cats getting very, very, very fat on this. And the simple solution, repeat this after me like a mantra, wages produce demand. Demand drives an economy. If you want to improve an economy, improve wages. What we are seeing is the predictable results of 28 years of Reaganomics, of the destruction of the American middle class, of the taking apart of good wage jobs. And it's continuing. You know, right now, you can turn on CNN or MSNBC or pretty much any of the networks, and with a few exceptions like Keith Olbermann or Rachel Maddow, what you will hear is, oh, look at how much money those auto workers are making. They even came up with a myth. The auto workers are making $70 an hour. Well, no, they're not. What they did was they took all the retired auto workers and all the health care for all the retired auto workers, took all of the costs of all the people who are working and the people who are not working, added it all together and divided by the number of people working today. This is an obscene lie on the part of the Reich. Because they don't want wages to go up, not for average people. Because it is all about, it's a kleptocracy. It's all about a plutocracy. It's all about rule by the rich. By the way, thanks to Wendy for correcting me. The Shining City on the Hill speech was by John Winthrop, not by Governor Bradford. Always good to keep things straight here. Dave in Portland, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Yeah, living in Newport, Rhode Island in the 80s, a couple of friends across the Saconic River in Little Compton, Rhode Island, knew a bunch of people who were descended from the Plymouth gang, and they migrated down there, John Alden, Elizabeth Seabury, among others. Uh-huh. And one Thanksgiving, they invited me out into the woods, and we had an old-fashioned heritage Thanksgiving dinner just like their ancestors had on a big stone table.
Huh. That sounds nice. Yeah.
Very cool.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that story with us, Dave, and thanks for listening to the show. John in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. What are you thankful for today, John?
Well, I'm just going to say Happy Thanksgiving, and I'm thankful that Obama got in by such a landslide.
Yeah.
One of the main reasons I was calling is that I'm a born-again Christian, and I'm also gay. And for the last 25 years, I felt that they should just do away with the nonprofit status for charities and churches, and the churches should be taxed. They also be taxed 10% and money go into a special government fund that cannot be touched by anybody or borrowed against, but used to help the poor, the homeless, help fund the national health care system, help build homes for the homeless, help feed the poor, help the disabled, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I don't disagree with doing away with tax exemptions for churches. Although I think that there are a lot of very small, you know, very living close to the bone churches that if they had to pay property taxes, if they had to pay taxes on their activities, might have a real struggle. I'm not gung-ho in favor of eliminating tax exemption. But if we did what you just suggested, it would be sort of like, you know, this whole thing about they want a means test Social Security, so only people who are not wealthy can get Social Security. Well, as soon as you do that, you throw it into the category of welfare, and then it becomes easy to whack at when the conservatives get into power. I'm concerned that if we were to ghettoize, essentially, programs for the poor by saying that they only are paid for by, you know, revenue from churches, that it takes it out of the mainstream of funding, it takes it out of the mainstream of all things. I'd rather just say, you know, if you're going to do away with tax exemption for churches, then, you know, just let them pay. If they show a profit, you know, as Pat Robertson has demonstrated, church organizations can do, if they show a profit, let them pay a corporate income tax on it. And otherwise they don't. I mean, churches use fire departments, they use police departments, they use the roads for people to get to the church. They use the commons, which is what the taxes pay for. Why not pay those taxes?
No. Oh, just a thought.
Yeah. It's a good one. It's a good one. I think there's a good germ in there, a good starting point. John, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks Thanks for being thankful on Thanksgiving. Todd in Seattle. Hey, Todd.
Hey, Tom.
What are you thankful for today?
You're asking the wrong guy.
Okay.
I have a wonderful wife and a wonderful mother.
Good.
But other than that, you know, I'm a little disappointed in my listening to your program is always a pleasure, and I'm thankful for you, Tom. Seriously, we do agree on, you know, a lot of the stuff I hear on your program, and I'm just wondering, though, you know, why a lot of stuff isn't getting highlighted, you know, in the press, and even on your show, because it's really tough, you know, so many issues get brought up, and you let the people have the floor to do that. But today I'm reading this this story about sneaking tax breaks in for mergers, bank mergers.
Right.
So in,
we talked about that about 2 weeks ago when the story first broke.
Right, and, you know, again, I'm a guy who pays attention. I'm listening all the time and reading things all the time, and I don't hear about this. And
yeah,
it is on here, so that's right. My point.
It is so wrong. These guys are into monopoly. They're into playing monopoly. This is a class war. This is class warfare on steroids. If you are a white collar corporation or institution, they are ready to hand you billions of dollars, no questions asked, and they don't mind if you pay yourself $100 million bonus or salary. And if you are a by and large blue collar corporation, AKA the auto industry, then you're paying your people way too much. We can't have that. And it's just wrong. Well identified, Todd. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And well said. Tupac in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Tupac.
Good afternoon, Tom.
That's you.
I want to say thanks for the grandmothers of the Western Shoshone Nation who are carrying on the struggle for human dignity and the Indian wars on behalf of the Indians in Western Shoshone territory today.
Yes, I agree. Did you know, you probably did, in the Shoshone language, there is no word, or there was at the time of first contact, there was no word for war.
You know, I think that that's a very good point, that the languages are the frontiers that we have to transcend in order to achieve our global humanity.
Yeah.
And part of that is we have to take the steps forward in terms of language to transcribe that into policy in terms of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which the U.S. government has failed to sign. They're the only four Anglophone governments on the planet.
Yeah.
To oppose that declaration.
And hopefully the Obama administration will. I'm right there with you, Tupac, and I totally agree. And thank you for calling and bringing it up. And, in fact, I devote a good chunk of a chapter in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, to the Shoshone. Mark Twain derisively referred to them as the diggers. But this was a society, as Peter Farb, the brilliant anthropologist who wrote Man's Rise to Civilization, is absolutely extraordinary. Anthropological treatise on first contact Native American groups across the United States. It's out of print now because he's dead, but you can find used copies of Man's Rise to Civilization by Peter Farb. And I use that, a lot of information from that, in The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And the Shoshone had, as Peter Farb said, a civilization as complex and cultured as the palace at Versailles, you know, as much cultural subtlety, there are no simple people. You know, it's just the way that people look from the outside to different cultures, you know. But the Shoshone were one of the most extraordinary tribes in North America. Prophet in Santa Barbara, you want to embrace globalization? Is that what you're grateful for?
No. Well, basically, what it's the we concept, thinking in terms of the whole earth, west and east, rather than us and them, being the United States and the separate entities. And all these problems we have, the economic meltdown, the global warming, war in all kinds of different countries, and the religious strife can all be solved by the we solution, which is a combination where we think in terms of the whole earth with the ecology, and think in terms of natural resources and how we have to protect those. And then we think in terms of the economy, though, having one monetary system throughout the world. So instead of the euro, we avoid monetary manipulation by having one monetary system. And
then I agree that there are certain commons that we should, as a world people, be paying very close attention to. Our atmosphere, the ecological commons, water. I mean, there are a number of commons that absolutely should be sacred and circumscribed and identified as commons, and we should collectively work on them. But What would happen if the entire world was on the dollar? I mean, keep in mind, Adolf Hitler said that he was going to produce a one-world government that would keep the world in peace for 1,000 years. That was the goal of the Third Reich. What would happen if the entire world was based on the dollar, and then we had this crash like we have right now?
Well, the whole world is crashing. The whole world is crashing right now, so it's kind of an indication that we are based on the dollar.
Well, to some extent, but I would say the fact that you've got other economies, you've got a diversity of economies, and you've got a diversity of currencies. Diversity is good. You want diversity in a gene pool. You want cultural diversity in a country. You want racial diversity. It creates strength right across the board. Diversity in ecosystems. Without diversity, when systems become monocultural, just a single species, a single culture, they become very, very fragile, Prophet. And that's my concern about globalization. I think as citizens of the planet, we need to identify those things that are destroying the planet and say, collectively, this is the commons that we're responsible for. The amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, for example. But beyond that, I think diversity is good. 45 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
We have a winner in Sean and Sue Nethercutt's selection of our finest post in our chat room today, our live chat room you can get to over at TomHartman.com. And who would that be, Sean?
That would be Fred42. He sent us a link earlier today, the 5 surprisingly effective all-natural aphrodisiacs that you probably have in your kitchen. Who knew? Tomatoes and cornstarch, sexy stuff.
Wow. Okay, great. It's like that church that's, have sex every day for a week. It's gone viral. No pun intended. Anyway, thank you, Sean. And thank you, Fred42. Congratulations. We're going to send you a copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And we'll send that out today. And by the way, everybody listening, thanks to you for listening to Progressive Talk Radio. And if you're thankful for our show, call your local station and let them know that you're thankful. Louise asks, if a person yells in chat, is there a sound? Is there an echo? I don't know. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. TalkRadioNews.com, the website. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Sometimes I think I'm just echo, but you never know.
Oh, not at all. And I am thankful for you, Victoria, you and the Talk Radio News Service. You're just great what you do.
Thank you very much. I'll pass that on to Ellen.
Victoria, I'm gonna have to take a 1 minute segment here. I'm gonna pop out of the news for just a moment and go to it. If that's okay, can I put you on hold for just a moment?
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry. We were having some trouble getting a hold of Steve. Steve Papai is the president of Automatic Response, Compax.com. Every week we try to highlight one of our advertisers on one of our local affiliates and the success that they're having with Progressive Talk Radio. And the compax.com is the website. Steve, am I pronouncing your last name right?
Well, pretty close. Papai.
Okay. Papai. Great. And this is you have a minute to tell us about your product and a minute to tell us about your experience advertising on Green 960 in San Francisco. So tell us about your product.
Great. Well, Tom, we actually have two products that we've advertised. The first one we started about a year ago when I met Sam Jarmo of Green 960 in San Francisco. And that is our paper shredding business. And what's unique about our shredding company is that we are inviting private individuals to drop in with their materials and bring them to us and watch them get shredded. So it's a little different than most shredding companies that drive to the huge companies with a big truck and shred there.
Mm-hmm.
We're oriented towards private individuals.
Oh, that's great. Has Dick Cheney shown up?
I'm sorry.
Bad joke. Never mind. It was a Dick Cheney.
Anyway, we thought the radio, as Sam described it, would be a perfect vehicle to get our word out to individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And spread the word and bring in customers and grow the customer account. And it's succeeded in doing that.
Great. And the other product you have?
More recently, we've advertised about our trash compactor and industrial equipment business, and it's a different slant. The customer we're looking for is property managers or business owners or facilities managers for companies rather than private individuals.
That's great. And how is Steve Papai, how is the average with compax.com automatic response as the company, how is the advertising working on Green 960 in San Francisco for you?
Very well, and it has two different approaches. We've noticed the traffic, and we do a customer count at our payment counter for the drop-in shredding, and the number of customers every day has been increasing, and we're very happy with that. And we ask each customer, how did you know about us? Oh, I heard you on the radio.
That's great.
So we also have an advertorial on once a week, and many folks have heard that.
That's great.
The second part of the business, the trash compactor, not so many people are into that type of business, but we find that once we get the right customer, we're going to create an account for life. And rather than a small ticket item, like a small shred job, we're attempting to sell capital improvement equipment that can run $10,000 to $30,000.
Marvelous. Steve, I've got to get back to our news here, but thank you so much for sharing your story with us. The website is compax.com, right?
It is. Thank you, Tom.
And 877-544-SHRED also is the telephone number.
877-544-SHRED.
54-SHRED. Great. Okay. Thank you very much, Steve. Great talking with you. Back to Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, quickly, what's going on in the world?
Well, as you may know, Barack Obama, the president-elect, appointed Paul Volcker to his Economic Advisory Board, the third news conference in 3 days he's had this week. It's like one a day now. It's quite extraordinary. Almost at the same time as he was doing that, the current president, President George W. Bush, was pardoning the Thanksgiving turkey. So there was a contrast in styles going on this morning of the two presidents.
I guess so. Any other pardons? Any other turkeys being pardoned? Have we heard if Bush is going to preemptively pardon turkeys like Dick Cheney?
No other pardons going on. We've heard nothing about that. No controversial pardons, apart from the guy who was killing bald eagles, which I thought myself, if I may editorialize for a moment, was outrageous.
Yeah, not a pardon that I would have given either. But Sarah Palin, at least Bush didn't have turkeys murdered in the background like Sarah Palin did while he was pardoning the turkey.
That's outrageous, as I continue to editorialize in the news here, but I take license.
Yeah.
Other piece of news which I thought was interesting, in Iraq, the Shia and the Kurds gave quite a major concession to the Sunnis in the security pact, in that they have agreed to a national referendum in 2009. Now, in this national referendum, the entire thing could be stopped.
That's great. That's very good news. Victoria, thanks for the news report. And my apologies for truncating it. Great talking to you. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Tomorrow we'll be taking the Thanksgiving holiday with our families. We hope you enjoy the best of Tom Hartman. From our house to yours, happy Thanksgiving. And Friday we'll be back live here with Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you Monday, or see you Friday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.